We return on another wonderful episode of the Wild Edible World Podcast. Wowie wow! I'm one of your hosts. My name's Michael.
And you know me, I am Steve. Welcome back. We missed you so much.
Yeah, it has been a minute through all of our life events, through an incredibly busy summer for both of us, and technical issues, ghosts in the machines. Another gremlin recently evacuated from our device.
Just a lot of things.
But hopefully we're back at you guys with some more high-quality interviews. And then we should get back to the play in action, too. Just, you know, maybe a couple you and me, just me and Steve episodes coming up, maybe.
Yeah, you'll have some good stuff coming through. We are here.
But we are here.
With the Ambassador of Acorns.
Admiral Acorn himself, yeah. Jesse Kosbeck. Right? I said it right, Jesse?
A Kosbeck. You were close.
Very close.
You were a close.
I was a close. He's a feral foraging, super reputable guy on the internet right now. Over 10,000 followers on Instagram,
You know Jesse. You know Jesse.
If you're into foraging, you probably know Jesse. Yeah. I had the pleasure of meeting Jesse at the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival last year.
I've never had the pleasure, but I'm hoping to this next season.
Yeah, and he's super awesome, super knowledgeable. Really happy to have Jesse from Feral Foraging on the show with us today, man. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to be here.
Has anyone ever called you Admiral Acorn before? Because that's pretty cool.
No, but I love it. I'm going to wear that like a badge.
Wear it like a, yeah, you need one of those like naval hat, one of those big like the, triangle hats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Admiral Acorn.
Napoleon of Nuts.
Oh, we're on one right
now. We're
on,
yeah, we're getting a little carried away.
So many different directions.
So we were really excited to talk about acorns with you. We've had an acorn episode before, but we're still kind of talking outside of our depth because we haven't personally really processed the nuts or anything. I don't really have the space for it. It's just a lot of work. But what was the beginning of your life experience with acorns?
Yeah, it's funny because my first experience with acorns was actually my first experience with foraging ever. In fact, I call it my foraging gateway drug. So I was attending university at the time. Yeah. I was attending university at the time and I was listening to this podcast called the Rewild Yourself podcast. The host was Daniel Vitalis. Before each episode started, he'd do a little monologue and talk about what's going on. And he kept talking about foraging and eating acorns. So what's funny is that my university I was attending is actually known for its oak trees. And I was biking around campus one day. Acorns were on my mind, and I just see this tree with a bunch of acorns littered at the base, like huge, perfect acorns. So I thought, okay, well, I'll try this out. So I went home, I got a bucket, I gathered probably about 2 gallons of these acorns, I brought them home, and then thought to myself, well, shoot, now I need to figure out what to do with these. I don't want them to go to waste. So I did some research and went through the process. I dried them, cracked them, leached them. Eventually I got my acorn flour and I made kind of like an acorn banana bread. It was almost like acorn brownies.
It sounds incredible.
I took my first bite and I was hooked. I was completely hooked. And it just opened up this whole new world for me. And this question of what else is out there that I can gather and eat like this. And I ask myself the question every day. And that's what continues to lead me along my foraging journey.
Well, you are a trooper, sir, because
yeah,
when I
awesome.
Think about harvesting acorns, and after I educated myself fully by watching all of your great videos on YouTube about the, I think you did a 3-part series, is that right? Or is it even more now?
I have, so the one that I did that's a little bit older at this point in time is long form content. Yeah, it's 3 or 4 videos, I think.
Mm-hmm.
However, I've been posting shorts, which I call the Acorn Series, which is going on right now, by the way. And that has much more up-to-date information on what I've learned over the past several years with processing and working with acorns.
Yeah, the dedication to listening to that, and you know, shout out to Daniel Vitalis, we miss your podcast so much. It was so good. But to find those things and then go through all the steps to process and leach and you know, prepare this, it's a lot for your first foraging thing. My first thing was a plum. Yeah. I was like, hey, look, it's on a tree. Let's
mulberries
put it in my mouth.
Are 80% of foragers' first thing. So acorns being the initial event that like sets you off on this journey.
Yeah, you're like all this
really
other
inspiring.
Easy.
Yeah, that's yeah, right. It's all easy from there. Do you remember what kind of tree you interacted with at the college? What kind of oak trees?
So looking at the time, I had no idea, absolutely no idea. But looking back, it was most likely a northern red oak.
Oh, interesting. So cool. Did you have to do a lot of leaching for that?
I would say, and actually this gets into a good point about acorns, that to me it was an average level of leaching. So what it took was, you know, I blend when I get the nut meat separated from the shells, I get them in water, and then I soak them, and then I blend them up into a flour consistency in the water. One, it's easiest to do that way, easiest on your blender, and then it increases the surface area so that you'll have an easier time with the leaching process. It'll go faster. And it probably takes, on average, with northern red oak, somewhere around 7 to 10 days, where I am changing the water twice a day, putting them in a kind of like a pitcher and pouring off the water from the top.
And that's considered cold leaching, right? As opposed to hot leaching, where you'd like boil it?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. What I was describing is cold leaching. You know what's funny is I still haven't actually done hot leach before. I've only done cold leaching. I need to do hot leaching just to try it to see how it turns out. But from my understanding, if you do hot leach, if you want to use the resulting flour for baking products, it's typically subpar what you end up with. It's not going to be able to bind well to other things. It's not going to be able to have any volume at all, which it already struggles with in terms of bread because there's no gluten in it.
Yeah.
And gluten is primarily the thing that allows a nice bread to stretch. You know, those really beautiful sourdoughs, a lot of that is the gluten that develops to give it that structure.
Sure.
So with using the hot leach, you're kind of compromising that even more. So if you were doing something like, you know, maybe a flatbread or tortilla type kind of things, then it might work out well. But I've always done cold leach, and it's worked really well for me.
I think that cold leach is the way to go. That's what I've always heard, anyway. I think I've listened to the Daniel Vitalis episode that you're talking about, and I've always heard cold leach. Plus, the idea of like a banana brownie acorn thing is all I can think about right now.
Yeah, you made that sound really good.
We recently, so I love that recipe, but I've had this feeling ever since I started foraging. I wanted my foraging meals to be uncompromisingly wild. And I had to take the banana out because that just didn't go with the motif that I was seeking out. Mm. And so my wife and I have come up with another recipe, which is an American persimmon acorn bread I also really, really love. And it checks off all the boxes of being a more truly wild bread.
That's awesome. My wife made persimmon brownies for the first time last year, and it was like mind-blowingly good. Shout out your wife, Jessie Laramie, who is also very cool, doing like lots of pigment research. We'll just do a quick plug right there because I love her pigment and paint work and all the cool work that she's doing. But back to acorns. So you've done mostly only cold leaching. Let's talk a little bit about like yield between like different like acorn types. So would you find that like or I guess it's a mast year. So would you find like this is a mast year, right? Do you want to talk a little bit about
what that is?
What that means
for people that don't know?
Yes. We'll talk about mast year, and then after that maybe we'll go back to some of the leaching and the tannin stuff. So
absolutely.
Just like a really quick thing to mention to everyone. Acorns should not be consumed raw. The thing is, they taste terrible raw. So if you thought maybe you could, you'd find out very quickly, no, this doesn't seem to be a good idea. But then on the mast year thing, so what's funny is that I would say that there is a high likelihood that every year is actually going to be a mast year for at least some species of oaks. Mask years seem to be correlated or seem to be true across a species or within a species. For instance, this year in North Alabama, chestnut oak is having a bumper year. I mean, they're dropping like snow. It's crazy. Additionally, chinkapin oak also having a crazy mass year. What, no matter what part of the town that I'm in, if I'm around a chinkapin oak, they're dropping acorns like crazy. Last year, that wasn't the case. Last year, we had a really amazing northern red oak season. And this year is a terrible red oak season. So acorns are, or oaks are, one of several different tree species that have a masting pattern for their fruit or nut production. Mm-hmm. There are several theories as to why this occurs. I think one of the more prominent ones that I've heard is to outcompete the animals or bugs that are the, for lack of a better term, the predators of acorns. So you have small numbers, so that they're never like getting their populations up too much. And then you just dump so many acorns on them that there's no way that they're going to be able to eat them all. And that is a better survival strategy for these trees to be getting out viable individuals to continue to reproduce.
Sort of like cicadas, sounds like, where it just like overloads the system.
Yeah. Yeah, basically so. And actually, the fact that they have a mass here, so I think that, well, you know, we should all be concerned about this as foragers and our impact on the environment. People are always very concerned that by a forager, by myself, taking acorns, oh no, all the squirrels are going to die now because we took some acorns. Of course, that isn't the case, but the biology of how this all works is kind of further helping us out with that situation of really not having an impact on them. Because the strategy of the oaks is to drop so many acorns that there is no way that any amount of animals are going to be able to get to all of them anyway. So what I actually think, and what I always argue, is by us humans taking part in that ecosystem, we are utilizing calories, you know, real and abundant source of calories that would otherwise just go completely unused. With, I mean, they're not going to waste, but they're not being used.
Sure.
And I see my consumption of those calories reducing my need for calories from agriculture. Squirrels do just fine in human settlement. Whenever we make human settlement, suburbs, cities, urban environments, so on, squirrels do just fine. However, many other animals, that is not the case. And when we have to plow a field, all of those animals aren't doing too well. So if we can reduce our need to plow more fields, then we can help out all of those animals. And I would argue that eating acorns is a really wonderful and delicious way that we can do our part to reduce the need for more and more fields.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I love that.
Yeah, we love a good wheat alternative here. For that, yeah, for the exact same reason that you were just saying. So they have different mast years. I didn't really think about that. So it's like different species have different mast years. And then do you know about them like happening kind of like pretty much all across the country? All the chinkapins will have a really good year for like across a really large distance? Or do you find that to be true or no?
That is a good question, and I don't have any hard data to answer it, but what I have found is if I make a video about and I showcase a certain oak species, that people who would be, let's say, you know, further up for me in New England might comment, oh, this was a really bad year for us for that species, where for me it was actually a pretty good year. So I would guess that it's probably more regional. How wide that region is, I'm not really sure. But it's certainly more than, you know, just the city from what I can tell.
Cool. Right on.
I have a question. Okay. I have a question that you may or may not know the answer to. Just in reference, since you're talking about acorn consumption and just I guess, the future of these big trees and whatnot. Do you think that there's any real threat to future acorn production or you know, old oak, old hickory production from an overpopulation of deer?
Of deer?
Yeah.
I would, if there's one thing that gives me concern mm-hmm. for oaks, it's not really an animal species. It's actually more of something like a bacteria or a fungus.
Sure.
There are some that I've heard of that are affecting oak species within the Southeast. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but that is what, you know, something like what infected the American chestnut. That would be a larger concern on my end for, you know, the future health of oaks than animal species are.
Got it. I've heard, I don't remember exactly where, one random podcast of 10,000, right? I've heard that, like, you know, deer love to graze on, like, seedlings. And so maybe the effect there is that the seedling population is being impacted, and so we'll end up with a bunch of old trees and maybe not so many young trees. I don't know. I was just throwing something out there to see if you knew more than I did.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that go on
sure.
in terms of the ecology. And one more thing that I'll add to what I talked about of humans going in and eating the acorns. The one part to that is that, you know, we then need to do our part to nurture and carry forth oaks, which I think more and more people should be doing. And I've been really excited to see a lot of other creators who are talking about gathering acorns for the purpose of germinating them to grow oaks. They are a really incredible species for not just squirrels, deers, chipmunks, etc., but they're also really incredible host species for, I think it's in the hundreds of different insect species.
Wow.
So, you know, not only just primary resource in the form of their leaves and acorns, but also another base layer in the trophic system of all of the insects that they support. So there's just, and a lot of information on that is in the book The Nature of Oaks by Douglas Ptolemy. Highly recommend that to your audience. It's a fantastic book. But there's just so many pluses to growing oaks, you know, in our environments. I always love seeing, you know, in some new developments, they're planting a lot of invasive shrubs and trees or just a bunch of maple or things like that. But I really love seeing some older, you know, just parking lots or urban environments where they have a bunch of water oaks or willow oaks or just different oak species. I always love seeing that.
Sure, absolutely. You know, Michael and I are huge on just like land stewardship in general. I mean, everybody wants this, you know, for our children or children's children or future generations. So, no, I think those are great points.
Yeah, and with every conversation, I guess there's a little bit of nuance. So it's like to be sort of the devil's advocate for like once in my life, it'll be it's like I just think like, yeah, you want to make sure that people are growing enough oaks, but you don't want too many oaks because that's like how a blight can spread and get started is because there's too, it's almost like a monoculture of trees. So there, I definitely like. We definitely need more oaks still, but like only so much or else.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's kind of funny you mentioned that because it makes me think of this is just like a funny like side metaphor or anecdote. We're talking about omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And in, you know, the health blogs, you'll always see omega-6 bad, omega-3 good. But from my understanding, it's not that black and white. It's more about making sure that there's a balance between the two of them. The thing is, of course, in at least the Western diet, basically you throw a rock in a crowd and whoever you hit is likely going to be far more towards the omega-6 end than the omega-3. So if you say omega-3s are good, then chances are you're right. But with all these things, of course, there's more nuance behind it.
Yeah, it's never black and white like that. It's never so easy. And if someone tells you it is, they're selling you something. Just like it's black and white that you should buy our merch. Yeah, anyway. How about, let's go back to...
The tannins.
Tannins, yeah.
Tell us about the tannins.
Yes.
A tale of tannins.
So, I think one of... a conception that I see very, very often one that I've held myself at a point in time, is that white oaks, low tannin, good. Red oaks, high tannin, bad, at least from a human consumption standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were just talking about, there's a lot of nuance to that. And I would argue it isn't necessarily true. So the first thing is that white oak, the white oak group, and just basically speaking, the white oak group of oaks, if you see an oak with softly lobed leaves, chances are it's a white oak. If you see an oak with sharp lobed leaves, chances are it's a red oak. So in the white oak group, on average, the species are going to have a lower tannin content than the red oak groups on average. Now, if we were to go species to species, you could certainly find a red oak species that has lower tannin content than a white oak species. But on average, that is true. However, from my perspective, no matter what the initial tannin content is, I'm going to leach them. I'm going to leach it all out. So maybe it takes a little bit longer for a red oak, but that's fine because it's all going to be gone in the end. And that extra, whatever it might be, 2 to 4 or 6 changes of water isn't a really huge impact to me. There are 2 major things that I'm looking for of an acorn that is a good acorn that I'm going to be going out of my way for. I want it to be large. So like the actual nut is large. Every crack will give me more nut meat, less cracks, less to deal with. That's why I would never go out of my way for something like pin oak, because the acorns are just so tiny. So that's the first thing. And then the other one would be storability or insect resistance. And this is where tannin may actually be a positive thing in some ways.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why the oak is even producing tannins is probably to combat against insects. And so for that reason, I tend to find that, let's say, northern red oak will have less acorn weevils that have infected the nuts than a different white oak species would have. And they also just, I find them to dry way easier, which is something that matters a lot to me because I like to store my acorns to use across the years.
You mean procrastinate?
And that's kind of what you do with the, sorry?
You mean procrastinate?
Right. A little bit of that too. Always. Yeah, I think that my, like, especially this time of the year where acorns are falling, hickory nuts are falling, black nuts are falling, like just so many things at once. It's just like, gather them, get them preserving so that in the wintertime, when there's not anything else to have to go for, I can just, you know, go through and process all of them and not have to worry about it while there are so many things that I'm trying to get to all at one point in time.
For sure. Yeah. It's harvest season, baby.
Yeah. That's great thinking right there. I'll tell you what.
So what's your process for drying?
For drying, if it's a small batch, I have used a dehydrator in the past. The important thing to know about using a dehydrator is if you are going to use one, dry them all the way, completely dry. Because, and I will say, Sam Thayer talks about this in his book. That's where I first read it from. Which one of his? It's Nature's Garden by Sam Thayer, which, by the way, one of the most amazing accounts of acorns. When I read his book,
it's like
after
a good
quarter
of the book is acorns.
Yeah. Yeah, I read his book after I'd been like bumbling around and experimenting with acorns for 2 or 3 years. It was just like, oh man, I should have read this way sooner. Like day one, I should have read this.
Sigh.
What's wrong, buddy?
Well, I just realized this mushroom supplement I bought isn't actually made with mushrooms. It's made with something called myceliated grain?
Myceliated grain?
Oh, no!
I'm sorry to tell you, buddy, but myceliated grain is a sure sign of a poor quality mushroom supplement.
Well, dang. I wanted mushrooms, not brown rice. What should I do?
Well, you should support a small batch producer from right here in the Midwest, Keweenaw Apothecary.
Keweenaw Apothecary? Tell me more.
Keweenaw Apothecary specializes in high-quality mushroom extracts from Michigan, and they always use real mushrooms, never, never, never myceliated grain.
That sounds like exactly what I've been looking for. Where can I order?
Well, you can find them at keweenawapothecary.com. Etsy.com. That's K-E-W-E-E-N-A-W, apothecary.etsy.com. Be sure to read their many excellent reviews.
Thanks, buddy. I don't want no low-quality mushroom products from a factory. I want Kiwino Apothecary.
Wowie, wow!
Oh, hey, Steve.
Oh, hey, Mike.
Well, what's wrong, buddy?
Well, I just got this new water bottle, but it just looks so plain.
Well, have I got the store for you. Introducing the Wild Edible World Podcast Merch Store.
Wowie, wow!
It's the merch store where you can get all of your favorite podcasts merch for all your decorating purposes.
How do I find that?
Go to wildedibleworldpod.shopify.com or go to any of our Instagram and media accounts and view the link in the bio.
Wowie, wow!
Yeah. So if I have a large harvest, which I like to work with acorns a lot, and I'm learning a lot about them every single year. So I gather a fair bit of acorns, far more than I can do in a dehydrator. What I do is I'll use like a flat, like a baking sheet, or I've even made these things with kind of like a mesh base, and I want them all in one layer. What I love using is just like a fan, a box fan, something doesn't have to be expensive, just some kind of fan, and I'm putting them in front of the fan at least for the first week or so, and just having the fan blow over them to increase the airflow. And then eventually, if I've run out of space or if it's getting too cold outside or it's too wet outside, then I'll just keep them on those baking sheets and I'll bring them inside, keeping them in a single layer. And I'll just let them slowly over the course of several weeks become dry. I'm always like cracking with you every couple days, every week or so, to make sure that they are progressing forward and to try to catch if any are going bad. They're kind of like apples. If you get a few that start to go really bad, they could mess up the rest of the batch. So It really is one of the most important parts to me.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good thinking right there. Practiced hand.
So you've lost a few batches before?
Oh, when I first started, I had no idea what I was doing. It was also just a very humid place where I was. I lost a lot of acorns just from not, I think one of the most critical parts is at the very beginning, you want to kind of have an accelerated rate of getting them to start drying. Towards the end, you can ease up on that. But yeah, if you don't get them drying fairly quickly, then they can go bad on you and, you know, then you've lost a lot of food, essentially.
What do you think your yield is on average? I know it probably varies, but from like pounds of acorn to like 1 pound of flour, for instance, or 1 quart of flour, what have you?
Yeah. It's funny that you should ask that, because I was actually just doing some research and trying to come up with a calculation of calories that you can get from acorns, which, by the way, from my estimation of just rough numbers that I've done, it does rival some agricultural crops in terms of productivity capability on like an acre of land per se. We're not talking about something like sugarcane or corn or potatoes, things like that. But, you know, in the millions of calories is what I would imagine that it would be.
Oh, wow.
So I think that you'd probably lose somewhere around 50% of the weight from, it's going to depend on the species, but let's say an average of 50%. So you're going to lose somewhere like around 30% of water loss and maybe another 25%, something like that, for the shell weight compared to the actual nut meat weight. Mm-hmm. So something like that would be a good prediction of what you actually end up with from gathering all the nuts wet to eventually ending up with dried acorn flour.
So when you have these nuts going bad, they turn like black. How do you know they're bad?
They turn. So one thing to mention is that if you dehydrate acorns, even on 95, they're going to turn darker in color. If everything else seems fine about them, but they're a little bit darker in hue, like a darker brown, that typically means that they're fine. And this is all also where you should be cracking them along the way to just, you know, get a sense of where they're going and what they're all looking like throughout the process. So a really easy way to tell if they're bad, of course, is like if there's going to be like holes in them, this gunky stuff, that means that there was an acorn weevil there. Doing a water separation, I have a video about this, is a fantastic way to just quickly get rid of a bunch of them that probably had weevils in them. I'm a fan of water separation. It doesn't work great in every situation, but it works great in a lot of situations. Another thing would just be, yeah, if it's like black, especially like sometimes you'll see it's black and only one half of the nut meat is, that's not a good sign. If it's moldy, if there's visible signs of, you know, bluish, whitish mold, that's another sign that these are not doing too good.
And you should probably discard with a high rate of discrimination because those nut funguses can like really mess you up from what I've heard, right?
So Sam has talked about the rancidity that happens with hickory nuts. And yeah, he has some pretty colorful accounts on how bad of an experience that it can be. Thankfully, I have never experienced that with acorns. So, but it's not, I'm still learning more about hickory nuts, so it's like really front of my mind. But, you know, if I do the float test and I get them drying quickly and I wash them through the drying process and I never notice any like weird colors or things like that going on, I feel very confident that I'm not going to experience ill effects from the acorn flour that I'm going to make as a result of it.
Cool. All right, that's reassuring.
And do you think that flour is by far your most popular use for acorns? Do you ever roast and candy them or anything along those lines?
Flour is, I would even say it's the only use that I've really made with them.
Okay.
I think that I had just to try it. I tried to make of what you think of like hickory nuts or walnuts or something like that with them, mm-hmm. and it just wasn't really good. There was an account that I read of this, and they described acorns as like a cereal grain growing on a tree. And I think that is actually a pretty good way to think about it. It's way more of like a flour carbohydrate than it is of what we traditionally think of as a nut.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what crunchy aspect I'm going to put on my pawpaw acorn flour brownies, you know? And I was thinking, hey, how about more acorns? But maybe keep to the drawing
maybe
board.
Maybe crumbled or yeah. I don't know. That's a good, roasted acorns maybe? I don't know. That's a good question, Steve. So when you have, I saw your video, I think it was just earlier today or yesterday, all about acorn starch. And that's the only thing I've used. So that's just a natural byproduct of the leaching process, right?
It can be, yes. And I have seen I don't even know if I've seen any accounts of this written by an English speaker, someone from North America on the use, or really centered around the use of acorn starch.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing research for this, I was noticing that I was losing all of my starch when I was leaching them. Everyone tells you, oh, just be careful when you're pouring it off that you don't lose the starch. Well, it's really light. It's really, really light. And so I was losing basically all of it by the time that I was done leaching, no matter how careful that I was. So I started to separate the starch before I actually really formally began the leaching process. And then it worked out so great, I wanted to do more research. And when I found, and it's really funny because I had to basically translate all these terms into Korean and search for them on YouTube. But I found people doing the exact thing that I had started to do with the acorn starch. In fact, in a lot of the cases, the nut or the acorn that they had over there, that most of the videos, it seemed to be sawtooth acorn or sawtooth oak acorns. Unfortunately, it's an invasive oak in our area, but it's native to Korea. And they were all, they're going straight for the starch. That's what all the processing was about. And it was just really cool to see that. Also, just I don't know how to say this, but shout out to Korea for having acorns continue to be a part of the main aspect of your cuisine. I think that is just amazing. And I don't know of any other place in the world where the consumption of acorns, or like balanophagy is the technical term, is still a part of the mainstream culture. And I just think that is so cool that they have that. You mentioned the Torimuk at the beginning, and I've made that myself just to try it out. And it's a really cool food product that you get from cooking the acorn starch.
So you said you can, yeah, so that's what it, okay, cooking the, so it can or can't, I'm sorry, earlier you said sometimes it produces acorn starch. What would be the process that, what do you do to extract the starch?
Right. So if you just start, if you blend up your acorns and then you pour them into a container, what you're going to see is that there's going to be a lighter color layer at the top that's always going to float kind of at the top. When you pour off your leaching water, it's going to be really difficult to not lose that. So what I do is I take all my acorns, I blend them all up. So now that they're in the flour, I would pour them straight into my leaching container, but instead I'm going to pour it through a cloth filter. It has to be a really fine filter. Otherwise you're going to get the actual flour particles, which you don't want in this case.
Right. I remember.
So I pour those into the
starch filter. Particles are a lot smaller, right?
Yeah. I think like 10 times smaller than a flour particle. Yeah. So I've got them all in my, behind my cloth filter. I wring out the cloth filter with my hands. I squeeze it as much as I can. And I'm going to get a really cloudy mixture in the container that I squeeze it into. I'm trying to capture all this. I don't want to lose any of that liquid. And then you just leave it for, you'll start to notice it after about half an hour, and it will form a layer of starch at the bottom. And I find that starch can, if you keep it on its own, it will help to kind of clump to itself. So then with this, I'm very careful and I pour that off the top. And I'm only going to do this a few times. A cool thing about the starch being so, so fine is that if there are any tannin components that are mixed within that, they're going to be leached out really fast. Like, I don't think it's ever taken me more than 3 changes of water with the isolated starch to get it to where I'm not tasting any astringency anymore. Mm. And then you get that all leached. And then you put that in a dehydrator. Dehydrate it. You're going to end up, it's going to look kind of like the cracks on like really dry earth. Mm-hmm. I put that all into a blender, blend it all up, and bam, you've got acorn starch. And it's amazing. I think it's so incredible. And it is a important part of acorns as food that a lot of people will miss if they try to leach everything all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have never thought about that.
Yeah. And you can still do the normal leaching process afterwards, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
So I have my isolated starch. I leach that very quickly. And then the rest of it, I leach just like normal. So it's just one additional step at the beginning, which is going to yield you not only like more of the acorn food, but something that has uses that are different than the flour, for thickening up soups, for making the turmeric, for all the things that we use starch for as an emulsifier. I was making a sauce just yesterday and I thought, I added in too much liquid. I was like, oh, shoot, I need something to emulsify this with the fats that are in here. And I used acorn starch, and it worked great.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, it's an amazing – to me, it's a really cool product to be able to get from the wild.
For sure.
Normally that would be from corn starch or potato starch, but acorns are right there for us to have this by picking them up straight off the ground.
Hell
That's
yeah.
So cool.
Shout out Korea.
For sure. Props.
Super props. Do you have any more questions, Steve?
Not off the top of my head.
Was there anything else that you wanted to bring up about acorns, or anything that we missed, Jesse?
I don't think so. We talked about leaching. We talked about... Oh, one other thing that I'll mention is... So this is funny. I talked about when I was at Auburn and I was looking for acorns. I would always... Or I just happened to find them around campus. The campus was... what we would consider an urban or a suburban environment. Mm-hmm. And everything was littered with acorns, like especially on a master for the Red Oaks. They were everywhere. Then I moved, when I graduated, I moved up to North Alabama. And I kind of went down a, I went astray on my foraging path. And I was looking for acorns in the woods. There was a lot more wooded areas that were near me. Mm-hmm. And whether it's acorns or other wild foods, there is very little of it in the woods. Mm-hmm. Because especially in the woods that are around me, they are just very overcrowded. So there's not a lot of sunlight access. So even on a mast deer, you're finding, you know, few, I mean, more than a few dozen, but they're difficult to find. They're difficult to gather in the woods. So if it's in like neighborhoods, I have knocked on people's doors, asked them if I can harvest their acorns. Everyone not only tells me that, yes, you can, but like, please, would you?
Yeah, please.
Because a lot of people just don't want them.
Yeah.
That was actually one of the best tips from you, one of your most recent videos that I saw was, you know, don't look for the patch of woods with oaks. Look for the standalones.
Exactly. Further, like, you can just watch in an area that has a lot of acorns, that's, let's say, in your neighborhood. I'd be willing to bet that a lot of the acorns year after year are just kind of like rotting or drying there in place.
Sure.
In these suburban environments, there aren't as many animal species that are able to get to them. Contrast that with the woods, right, where there are a lot more animal species that are relying on them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mm-hmm. you know, in a neighborhood, suburban environment, no one's going after those acorns. So that's where us as foragers can step in and we can really take part in our ecology.
We are all about that. Love that, Jesse.
Jesse, before we called you today, Michael and I were chit-chatting a bit, and I was like, you know what I want to ask Jesse is why? It seems like such a process.
Yeah.
Why acorns? But you got me, buddy. I'm signed up.
Yeah, I'm
Let's
convinced.
Do it. I'm going right now. Is it still daylight outside?
Yeah,
Let's
right.
do this.
Awesome. Happy to hear that. Hey, I'll tell you what. While, you know, if it's still daylight and you're able to get some acorns and you post them online in any way, hashtag with acorn series. I've been following that, and I really want to make this kind of like a community collaborative effort of everyone learning how to utilize and showing that they're building a relationship with oaks and acorns.
Sounds great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll encourage our listeners, if you guys you know, pick anything up from this episode and you're out there inspired, definitely share with hashtag acorn series. Jesse, do you have a favorite species of oak tree?
There are two that I would consider like my favorites. So I'll start with the second one to build up to the other one. The second one is the northern red oak that I talked about. Mm-hmm. A lot of northern red oak that are in suburban environments just produce like really, I've been avoiding saying this, but I'll just say it, really huge nuts. They make really huge nuts.
Oh, you've been trying not to say it?
I kept on saying acorns, but I feel like we've gotten to that point. I can say really huge nuts with you guys.
I'm glad we've breached that level of acquaintance.
Right. And as I mentioned before, with a lot of the red oaks, particularly this northern red oak, they store very easily. They dry very easily. They're very forgiving from that perspective. So that's one of them. The other one is bur oak, Quercus mm-hmm. macrocarpa. Mm-hmm. And that species name, macrocarpa, is for large fruit. And at least in my area, I'm informed that in more northern states, they're not quite as large. In fact, I think that I was even told that in the northern states, it's one of their smallest acorns. But down here in North Alabama, that's certainly not the case. They are massive, like 2 to sometimes 3 times the size of the next largest species that we have down here.
Oh, geez.
Wow.
That's awesome.
The thing about bur oak, there's a lot of variation within the species, it seems. I'm learning more about that and trying to document it. So not all the nuts that they produce are great for a forager. They have a cap that is really large and kind of envelops 2/3 of the acorn. Mm-hmm. And if that cap grows in a certain way, like with certain individual trees, it'll really go around it. And it's just difficult to get it off. So that's not great. But there's one tree in my area where it doesn't. And so the acorn nut falls out of the cap very easily. So that's awesome. So sometimes the cap isn't great. They are low, very low in tans from what I found. Sometimes good, but they really get infected by acorn weevils quite a bit. Because they're so large, they're harder to get to dry and dehydrate. But I tell everyone, for all of its faults, for all the things wrong with bur oak, the fact that those acorn arts are so large, it doesn't matter to me. It always completely makes up for it. And that's why it's definitely my favorite. Cracking them is a dream. You don't need any specialized equipment, any specialized nutcracker, and you can get a very significant amount of acorns for flour in no time at all, like under 15 minutes, and you have a very, very large batch to make acorn flour with. And speaking of, I think a lot of people, when they are using acorns, they're using too small of an amount. And so they end up with, like, you know, enough to make like one set of pancakes or something. And like, well, that wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's totally the case. But if you're doing larger batches, that's where you start to see, oh, okay, like I can see how this is really going to be worth it to make like what's essentially like bulk carbohydrates in one go.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you breaking them down with just like a hammer in the floor?
So what I have started to do, again, this is where I kicked myself reading Sam Thayer's book. He talks about using like a long blunt stick. And the reason why that's so great, so I'll set them all up kind of like on a mat on the ground.
Kind of like a
small
log.
And I'll use that and I can hit them. What's that?
Like a smaller log, right? So you can hit like a group of, you can pound like a group of nuts at once.
Yeah, you can pound a group of them at once, but also if you're using something long, you don't have to be hunched over. And that's where a lot of like it kind of like wearing on you is going to happen if you're doing a large batch for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always done that. I've done that for several years. It's worked amazing. But I did just invest in a Dave Built nutcracker. And that
yeah,
was a,
brother.
A game changer.
Oh, man, I'm so jealous. Oh, I want one so bad. You had to like call them, right?
Yeah, I had to contact them. And I had to, I think I had to email them or something on their website to put an order in. It took several months to get it, and it's not the cheapest thing in the world. But for me, it is a vital tool. If you are cracking dozens of acorns, that's perfectly fine to do with a hammer or with the method that we just talked about. But I want to process hundreds and hundreds of acorns, and it's, you know, that's just the most tedious part of the process. And the Dave Built Nutcracker removes that as a blocker for me. So I've been experimenting with it more this year and kind of like tinkering with getting the settings just right. And it's been working amazing so far.
Awesome. Yeah, that's been on my wish list for a while. It is a very cool piece of machinery that you can only find like, it's only worth getting like this handmade piece of like cast iron equipment from the Dave Built people. There's always like a model or two sitting around at the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival, which is the first time I saw it. And then just watching people just like pour bags of hazelnuts into this machine while they just like sit there and twist this handle. And it's just like churning out all these cracked nuts just perfectly. Yeah, super jealous.
Yeah, it's if anyone's listening and well, probably you're a forger or you have a forger in your life. The Dave Built is like the perfect gift.
Yeah, definitely. It really is. Yeah, wink, wink, my wife. So I think we're pretty much out of time, but I think we covered all of our bases anyway. You have anything to add, Steve?
No, I just enjoyed this so much. Let's do it again, Jesse.
Yeah, it was cool as hell.
Awesome. Likewise. Yeah. All kinds of things down here in the Southeast to talk about related to foraging. The one thing that I'll mention, if people are inspired, I hope that you were, to forage acorns and to eat acorns after processing them. I do have a video series that is online. Every part of it is free, called the Acorn Series. Whatever social media platform that you're on, you can probably find it on there, on Feral Foraging. So yeah, I would encourage you to go check that out if you want to see every part of the process that we talked about here laid out and some extra tips and so on for how to make this really worthwhile and how to make it a really wonderful experience.
Definitely. Awesome. Yeah. Jesse at Feral Foraging. And thanks for listening. Thanks for chatting with us, Jesse. It was really awesome sharing your knowledge with us. Hope we can see you again next year sometime. See you in person, maybe.
That'd be excellent.
Yeah.
For sure.
Likewise. Yeah, I would love that.
All right. Thanks, Jesse. You have a great week, man.
You guys too. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Woohoo! That was Jesse. He loves big nuts. That's what his words, not mine.
The man loves. The man knows his nut meats. You know.
He does. Yeah. You love, you know, a man that knows his nut meats. You got to be familiar with those kinds of things.
But if you aren't familiar with Jesse, you should make yourself. I mean, he's got a huge following on YouTube.
Yeah.
He's got close to 80,000 followers on Instagram. Like just.
Oh really?
Just like.
Dang.
Stacked, and plus he's. I mean, if for no other reason than he's just this wealth of knowledge, and he communicates. You know, so clearly,
yeah.
And he's such a great video editor,
mm-hmm.
and everything he's doing is like kicking ass.
Yeah,
so.
He works very hard to bring a lot of this information for free to people. So
yeah.
Definitely support him. He's kicking ass, taking names. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we were super happy to have him. Cool. It's been good to get back with you again, Steve.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, dude.
Yeah, we have lots of exciting things coming out soon. We've been working really hard
so
behind the scenes.
So many exciting things.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully this next year will be a pretty big year for us, and we'll have some live events for you guys. We'll be bringing you more hot sauce, more merch. We're good with it. So love you guys.
Miss you already.
Thanks for listening to the Wild Edible World podcast. I've been Michael. You can follow me at edible_Illinois.
And I am Steve. You can follow me at my more frequently used Stevie Cantu, like the Pokemon Eevee, Stevie Cantu, or also Snoop Doggy Dogwood, in case you want zero content. but you get to see my cute kid and stuff.
Yeah, and thanks to Brett Westcott for designing and making all of our music. He's done really awesome work. Thank you, Brett. And thank you to Laura Feller for making our awesome logo and all of our merch, pretty much.
Yeah, the one and only Laura Feller.
Yeah, doing
Baker.
All of our artwork. So
I don't know. What do you do? Do you hyphenate?
No.
No?
Just Feller.
Just exist?
Yep.
Okay, cool. I like it.
So thanks to everybody for listening and supporting the podcast as well. If you want to reach out to us at wildediblewordpod@gmail.com, we'd love to hear from you. Thanks, guys.
Bye.